The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey, folks. Today we have a special presentation of the Eric Metaxas Show. We're going to play my interview, my conversation with the great, now late, Charlie Daniels from a couple of years ago. Really excited to share that with you. Thanks for listening.
To the Eric Metaxas Show.
It's the show that Mark Twain once called smarter'n a blue jay what can talk possum and faster'n a naked fat man riding a bolt of lightning.
So here's your plain-spoken homespun host, Eric Metaxas.
Howdy there, folks. This is Eric Metaxas. And, you know, it's such a joy for me sometimes to get to talk to folks on this program. The people I get to talk to, and I hope it's fun for you to listen in, but today I'm speaking to somebody who I consider an American legend. No, it is not Mr. Davy Crockett or Paul Bunyan. It's somebody you know as Charlie Daniels. He's on the line. Charlie Daniels, welcome to this program.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you, Eric. Thanks a bunch for having me on this morning.
Well, and it's great to have you on. I wish you were in the studio, but I did have the joy of meeting you down in Nashville, just about a year ago today. This week, I think, in Nashville. So I had the joy of meeting you, but it's wonderful to have you on the program. Today I want to talk about your life. You have a brand new book out. Now, this book obviously has your picture on the cover because it's your story, but the title is Never Look at the Empty Seats, a memoir by Charlie Daniels. So I want to start there before we get into the background of your whole story. When you say, what do you mean by never look at the empty seats? I think I know what you mean, but when you say it.
Well, it's kind of a nod to the accentuate the positive. You know, when you're a young musician, if you're serious about it, and I was, and you're looking for a career and a long career, longevity and a stable career, you're going to play about anywhere they'll let you for whatever they'll give you for whoever's in the building.
Yeah.
And what you got to do, you want to play, there's going to be a lot of empty seats because nobody knows you.
Yeah.
So you start out, you learn right away, you play for the seats that have people in them. You're not concerned with the empty seats. You don't look at them. So it's like saying, you know, play for who you got. Then they'll come back and bring somebody else with them. And first thing you know, you got a following.
Well, you got quite a following at this point. But I want to start at the beginning just because this is a book about your life. And most people probably don't know the story of your life. Some people only know you from your gigantic hit, Devil Went Down to Georgia. What year was that that blasted into the stratosphere?
1979 was the year that came out.
And that kind of was like one of those things, like a rocket ship. I mean, wherever you were in America, you were aware suddenly of Charlie Daniels. I was in high school at the time. I didn't follow country music very much. And then suddenly everybody is singing that song, playing that song. What was your life like at that point? In other words, did you expect to break through? Did you have a big album coming out and you just expected it to be a success, but this was more of an success than you thought? Or did it just come out of nowhere? What was that experience like?
Well, we didn't actually know what was going on. You never know when you record something. You've got an idea. Maybe it may do well, but you don't really know. So that was actually not the first single that was released off of that album. The first thing was a song called Behind Your Eyes. It did fair, but not really well. But we had success before, but it was like changing into high gear when this happened. It happened pretty quick, actually. It started playing on as it was back in those days before all the consultants came on board. It started playing on the smaller stations and then quickly worked its way up to the bigger stations and the bigger markets. And it started charting, and the album started selling. And it went number one country. It went way up in the pop charts. And it was the first platinum album we had. We had gold albums, but we never had a platinum album. This one got that way pretty soon. And it went on to be multi-platinum. It's is over 3 million records now.
Holy cow.
So it was, you know, it was just it happened. It was as big a surprise to us as it was to anybody. And we were out traveling, you know, doing shows and all while all this was happening. And we were watching the size of the venues, the size of the crowds, the radio play we got, and all that start to expand. And it was just, like I say, we were as amazed as anybody else was.
Well, it's just kind of funny because in life you can't predict anything like that. You know, you just try to be faithful. Do what you're doing as well as you can do it. And sometimes something like this just happens out of the blue. It really is extraordinary in your case because it was so big. I want to ask you really about your whole life. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Wilmington, North Carolina, October 28, 1936, and quite a different world than the one we live in right now. Some of my earliest memories are the day the Second World War started, the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed. We were listening to it on my whole family was at my granddad's house. I guess we'd had Sunday dinner with him or something. It was on a Sunday. And we didn't have TV, and it came over the radio, just a scratchy overseas broadcast that told us about what had happened in Pearl Harbor. And my formative years, basically, were shaped a lot by the Second World War. Wilmington, North Carolina was a place strategic part in the war because we had a shipyard that built Liberty ships, and we were a seaport town.
Right.
Where oil tankers and cargo boats sailed across the Atlantic to service our troops in Europe, and a lot of them were sunk just off our shores by U-boats. And sometimes, of course, I was too young.
See, that's hard to believe. I got to tell you. I mean, when you think about the United States of America, that we are bounded, on either side, protected by vast oceans. The idea that you're in North Carolina and you're telling me German U-boats were right there sinking our ships. That's an extraordinary thing.
Sometimes it was said that it was so close you could see the fires of battle from our beaches.
Holy
and of course,
God.
I was too young to know anything about that. But, the war was very real to us. We didn't have all the satellite technology and to know where the troops were and all. We never knew but what the Nazis might try to bring the war on shore.
Right.
So we were very vigilant. The war was very real to us. It was just there. It was in our backyard. So. That had a lot to do with my attitudes toward patriotism. And I learned very early in my life that the only two things that protect America, the grace of God and the United States military. It's that simple. And that was something I learned, when I was still in single digits.
So what kind of a home were you raised in? Was it a family of Christian faith or not so much?
No, I was raised in a family of Christian faith. I was raised in both sides of my family were as far back as I can remember, were Methodists. We went to the Methodist church, and my mother's side and my dad's side. And, it's just the weirdest thing because and the hardest chapter for me to write in this whole book was about my faith. I wanted to be so meticulous. I wanted to be exactly right about how I felt. I didn't want a wrong word in it, and it took me a good while and an awful lot of thinking and thinking in retrospect to get it right. But I had heard all my life, and I believed that Jesus died for my sins, but I didn't know why. I didn't know why he had to. As I have looked back, it's like everybody, it seemed, talked about the wrath of God, but very few people talked about the love of God.
A problem over the centuries.
Well, it was almost like with the churches I went to, that the preachers thought that everybody knew the gospel message before you ever walked through the door. You know, they just expanded on that rather than going back to basics. So it was a long journey for me. I decided I'd read the Bible for myself and, you know, make my own mind up and
work out
my own salvation.
At what point did you?
Oh, I was in my, 30s.
In your 30s before, right. So you were raised in a strongly cultural Christian environment, but the penny didn't drop till later for you.
It took a while for me to get the gist of it. Yes, it did.
Now, when we come back, I want to ask you about when you were a little kid, if you had always planned to be a musician or something? You can give me the short answer now, but when I come back, I want to get into that.
There is no short answer, but I'll be glad to give you the long
answer. There's no short. Well, lucky for both of us, we have time for the long answer. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Eric Metaxas Show, and I have the privilege of speaking to Mr. Charlie Daniels. His brand new book titled Never Look at the Empty Seats, a memoir by Charlie Daniels. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We'll be right back.
Down to Georgia, he was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what, I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too, and if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you. The boy said, my name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet you're going to regret, because I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, because hell's broke loose in Georgia, and the devil deals at cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul.
Oh, man, I hate to interrupt that unbelievable song. The only good thing about interrupting that song is I get to talk to the man behind the song right now, Charlie Daniels. Once again, welcome to this program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you, my friend.
It's just so great to have you on. And we are just talking. I always want to know from people who have been very successful in their field, you know, at what point did music come into your life where you said, this is something I want to pursue? Was that when you were little, or were your folks musicians? How did that work out for you?
There were no musicians, basically, in my family. Everybody loved music. My dad loved to sing. I mean, he used to go to church and sing. They loved to have him come because he just cut loose, you know. There was something about music in me. Before I ever had any thought about playing anything at all, I used to go to shows, and that once in a while some country act would come through town and I'd go see it, and I just sat there fascinated and think, gosh, I'd love to do that. And I never had an opportunity to learn anything until I was about 15 years old. I finally got a chance to learn to play guitar. But I had something in me that attracted me to, before I ever had a chance to learn the first chord on a guitar, there was something about music, about being on stage, that attracted me in that direction. And I guess subconsciously I was just waiting for a piece of dirt to plant seed in.
That's a good way of putting it. Now, you started on the guitar. At what point does the fiddle come into the picture?
Well, I was probably 14 and a half, 15, something like that, when I started playing guitar. And I was about 16 when I started playing fiddle. You know, nowadays, every kid, just about every third kid's a guitar player.
Yeah.
But back in those days, it really wasn't. There were very few people that played any instruments at all around the small towns I was in. And a guy named Russell Palmer taught me my first three chords on a guitar. And after that, I was ruined, because you could play a whole song with three chords, and that was about the most exciting thing that ever happened to me. And after I learned those first three chords, it's all I ever wanted to do. I never wanted to be anything but a professional musician, but it was to be quite a while before I would be able to attain that, because the opportunities were very, very limited at that time.
So what did you do with yourself?
Well, I just kept trying to, you know, trying to learn my instrument, and especially after I got started on fiddle. One of the kids I went to school with said, when I first started playing, said, when I played the fiddle, it sounded like somebody stepped on a cat. And it did. I mean, it was squeaking and squawking, but I spent a lot of time learning. I am not a natural musician. I am, I had to struggle. I had to really struggle to learn to play. Some people take to it like, you know, like a fish to water. I never did. I it was just my desire that I wanted to do it so bad that drove me on to learn how to play it all. But I am not, I'm still to this very day, I got a bunch of guys that play with me that are just incredibly good and talented, and they're natural to them. And we learn a new song, and they pick it up and just go right on with it. I have to take a little, you know, it takes me some woodshedding and stuff. It takes me a little time to get it done.
But you get it done, I think. Were you working other jobs and playing on the side? Or what point do you try to do this full time, or did that take a long time?
It took a long time. I first started learning to play, as I said, when I was about 14, 15 years old, and I finished school in 1956 and started a daytime job. And one of the places I worked in Wilmington. My family moved. We were living up in central part of North Carolina. We moved back to Wilmington, and I went to work at the same place my dad worked at. It was called Taylor Cockwood Chrysoting Company, and I was a timber inspector. I inspected poles and piling and timber. There was a lady in Wilmington. Her professional name was Little Jill, and she was putting a band together to play six nights a week in Jacksonville, North Carolina, which is about 50 miles from Wilmington. And I joined in, so I was working a daytime job and a nighttime job. And I had no social life, and I very little sleep, and I was doing 6.5 days on my daytime job and 6 nights a week on my nighttime job. But I didn't care because I was doing what I wanted to, playing music. In 1958, the business slowed down, and there was a gentleman that worked with me by the name of Louis Frost that knew 10 times more about the job than I did. I mean, I learned from him. He taught me, and he should have been running that part of the company that I was working for, but it was back in the segregation day, or back in the days when, for all practical purposes, Jim Crow laws were still in effect. And because he was black, they would not give it to him. And when they started laying somebody off, they were going to lay him off. I said, no, don't lay him off. I've got another job. Lay me off. And my dad, something really nice happened because of that. My dad went to his boss and said, Mac, Lewis has been here a long time. He needs to be on straight time. He just make a straight salary rather than being paid by the hour. Mm. He needs to run this department. He's capable. He's got it all down. He knows how to do it. Let's do it. And the guy told my dad, his boss said, we can't do that because he's black. My dad said, I'm willing to take my job on this, Mac. Let's do this. Let's do something right for a change. And they did. The upshot of the whole thing was, is Lewis did take over. He did go on straight time, and he did stay there. He retired several years later, and I went on to pursue my music.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing in the 50s in North Carolina for somebody to step up like that. What do you think it was that made your father do that? Because that is a big thing to put your job on the line for a black.
It was the right. It was the right thing to do.
Well,
because it was. I mean, it was the right. It was the only thing to do. It made no sense. This guy had trained me. He had trained my dad. He had been around for years and years. He was the best guy for the job. It was to the company's advantage to do that. And it was just the right thing to do. And Dad just said, it's the right thing to do, Mike. Let's just do it. And like I said, my dad was probably the best timber guy in the country. He thought about timber like I do about music.
Wait, say it again. Timber, you said, yeah.
More about a pine tree than any man I've ever seen. And he was valuable to his company, and his word meant something. So when he insisted on this, I guess they figured, well, we want to keep Carl Daniels around. I guess we better keep Lewis, too. So they went ahead and did it. And it was, I guess, a first probably, at least at that company. But it was just the right thing to do. It was just that was when I guess it was starting to dawn on a lot of us, and it took a long time for it to get through. But that how silly, how cruel, and how non-productive that the whole thing was, the whole racial thing was. Mm. And when you come up in that surrounding, you don't know any better. I mean, it's like bad blood just passed from generation to generation, and you don't know any better. You find out for yourself, hey, wait a minute, this is wrong. This is, these color of somebody's skin does not make them good, bad, indifferent, or certainly not affect their employment. And it's something you learn for yourself. my first lesson in watching somebody stand up for what was right. It happened to be my dad, and I've always been proud of him for that.
Well, that's an amazing thing, because just because something's right doesn't mean people are going to do it. I mean, there's so many people that they will look the other way, and so when somebody does it, it's an inspiration to everybody around them. They just say, "Wow, I didn't know you could, you know, step up like that." So that's kind of an amazing thing in that day and age. Even Billy Graham had to make a big deal to integrate his crusades. It's an extraordinary thing to think back that he had to tell people, "Look, I don't care what you think or what you've been doing. We believe that God made us equal. So in these crusades, we're not going to have a black section and a white section. We're just going to have a human section." But it's hard to believe really how big of a deal that was not so many years ago. I'm sure it's still very vivid in your mind. We're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to Charlie Daniels. We're going to be right back, and we're going to let him finish that sentence when we come back. It's the Eric Metaxas Show, MetaxasTalk.com.
I have to work like a dog to make ends meet. There's crooked politicians and crime in the street, and I'm madder than hell, and I ain't gonna take it no more. We tell our kids just say no, and then some panty-waist judge lets a drug dealer go, slaps him on the wrist, and he turns it back out on the town.
The Trump campaign has a special offer just for you. President Trump wants to meet you. This will be the first opportunity he's had to meet with American patriots like you since our country started reopening. His team will cover the flight and hotel and give you VIP access for yourself and a guest. He'll even take a picture with you. All you have to do is text VIP to 88022 today for your chance to meet President Trump. Again, that's VIP to 88022 for your chance to win and join President Trump in the fight to keep America great for four more years.
People say I'm no good, crazy as a loon, 'cause I get stoned in the morning and I get drunk in the afternoon. Kinda like my old blue tick hound, like to lay around in the shade. And I ain't got no money, but I damn sure got it made. 'Cause I ain't asking nobody for nothing if I can't get it on my own.
Oh, man. That's an ode to pride. What a song there. It's like it reminds me of Frank Sinatra's I Did It My Way.
Well, I've changed the lyrics since then.
You have not done it your way the whole way, Charlie Daniels.
No,
that's an amazing thing. Well, that's a beauty to me about art. You can express these things. It doesn't mean that it's you speaking. It's a character in a way. And a lot of us know men like that, you know, who are just, I don't want to owe anybody anything, and I want you to give me anything. I want to, you know, and it's pride. It gets to be real ugly. It can get real ugly. But your life changed dramatically. You were going to say something when we went to the break. I don't know if you remember what that was. Otherwise, I've got
to. I was just going to say that with you. We were talking about how long ago that was, about the job thing. And it was 1958, so it's been a long, long time ago.
Well, it's hard to believe that, you know, we lived in a world not so long ago. It's an extraordinary thing. Well, so you're a young man, you're starting to play. Did you have any early success? And at what point did you decide you want to get married? Where were you in your 20s as life is going by?
Well, I once I learned three chords, all I ever wanted to do was play music. I was just hot in pursuit of it all the time. I left North Carolina and went up to the Washington, D.C. area to, to pursue my career. There's more opportunities there. And when I was 24 years old, I met a girl, and I got married. And I stayed married about a year and a half. I had been married about 2 weeks when I realized I'd made the worst mistake of my life. And I ended up getting a divorce a year and a half later, but marriage is a very, very sacred commitment, and I made my mind up I would never, never ever play it cheap or whatever. I think I was doing that the first time I got married. I didn't mean to, but that's the way it worked out, that I married somebody I couldn't live with. And the 20th of this month, my current wife and myself will be married for 54 years. So I took it pretty serious.
So the second one was a charm. That is 54 oh, yeah. years. Congratulations. 54, that
yeah,
is,
pardon me, 53 years. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Well, when you hit 50, you don't need to remember the single digits. That is really, really, that's amazing. I had the privilege of meeting your wife when we were together in Nashville last fall. And that's a long time. And you have kids.
It is a long time.
You do have kids.
We have one son. Yeah, he's 50. He's 51 years old. Yeah.
Unbelievable. So things were kind of rocky in the early years of Charlie Daniels. It sounds like it.
Yeah. Well, it was. I mean, you know, you go through this. This, of course, going through the mad marriage was one thing, and once that was over with, I was pretty, I don't like to say wild, because I was never the kind of person that got into all kinds of trouble and stuff, but I lived a pretty undisciplined life for a good little while when I was young and single, especially after I got divorced, and I was living in El Paso, Texas at the time, and I had gone there to pursue my musical career, and of course, Juarez, Mexico is right across the street, and I spent a lot of time over there, you know, just drinking way too much alcohol, and I finally decided that I was just partying my life away on a Mexican border while the world was passing me by, and that's not what I started out to do, and I said, I'm going back and getting the game, which I did. I called some friends back east, and this is in 1962, and they said, come on back, let's work on it. And I did. And I've been blessed enough to know, first of all, what I wanted to do. I had no doubt about, you know, a lot of times with young people, that's one of the problems they have. They don't really know what they want to do.
Mm.
But I had no doubt. I wanted to play music, and that's all I cared about. I didn't care about anything else. And so I just pursued it just as hard as I could go, and wherever the trail led. In 19, I had moved up to actually Kentucky. I was playing up there, and a friend of mine, Bob Johnston, had moved to Nashville and had taken over the Columbia operation there, Columbia Records. I had met him in Fort Worth, Texas, in 1959, and then he moved to Nashville. And we had written a song. We used to write together all the time. We'd written a song that Elvis Presley recorded in 1963 called It Hurts Me. And it was the first national success I'd ever had. And we stayed in touch all that time. So when he took over, and he had moved to New York, and he had had a lot of success with Bob Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel and a bunch of people, when a guy named Don Law, who was a legendary producer in Nashville, retired, they asked Bob to take over, and he did. And he called me and said, you want to come to Nashville? Which took me all about 30 seconds to say, yeah. Uh-huh. And I did. I moved to Nashville in 1967, and I've been there ever since. And, of course, that was another whole trip.
You've been there ever since. All right, we're gonna go to another break. The good news when we go to break is that we get to hear some more Charlie Daniels music. We'll be right back, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show.
Taking a trip out to L.A., tooling along in my Chevrolet, toking on a number and digging on the radio. Just as I crossed the Mississippi line, I heard that highway start to whine, and I knew that left rear tire was about to go. Well, the spare was flat, and I got up tight, cause there wasn't a filling station in sight, so I just limped on down the shoulder on the rim. I went as far as I could, and when I stopped the car, it was right in front of this little bar, kind of a redneck-looking joint called the Dewdrop Inn. Well, I stuffed my hair up under my hat, told the bartender that I had a flat, and would he be kind enough to give me change for a one?
Hey there, folks. I can listen to this all day. The problem is I got to do a radio program. But the good news is that instead of listening to Charlie Daniels sing, I get to talk to Charlie Daniels. You get to listen. Charlie Daniels, once again, welcome to the program. It's such a joy to have you today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm excited somebody finally twisted your arm into writing a book. Who twisted your arm into finally writing a book about your life?
Well, nobody really twisted my arm. It's just to say it was something I wanted to do. It was something I didn't know I could do until, you know, it's just another talent I had that I didn't know about. And so I started exploring it. I wrote on this thing for 20 years.
Whoa.
I just kept putting my memories down, and I kept editing it and trying to keep it interesting and flowing, but I could never find a place to end it because things kept happening. Things kept happening that were interesting. I never got to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry until I was in my 70s, and things just kept happening. So I couldn't find a place to pause it. I won't say to stop it, but to pause it until I was told I was going to be inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I thought, what a great place.
And when, you know, what year was that?
That was last year.
That's what I thought. 16, so you turned you turned 80.
My 80th birthday was just a few days after I was inducted, yeah.
That's a pretty good week.
It's a great week. Believe me. I went home. Actually, after the morning after the induction ceremony, I sat down and wrote my impressions of the induction ceremony and back wrote to where I was, and that book was finished. I had it done.
You said, that's it. Whatever happens from now, that goes in volume two. I don't care.
That's right.
All right. Well, that, it's incredible. I mean, the book is loaded with, you know, bold print names, people that most people just dream of meeting, you know, from Beatles like Ringo Starr, George Harrison, to everybody in the country business. I guess when you moved to Nashville in 1967, things began to change just because of where you were. And I guess you got married about that time.
No, well, I was married before I moved to Nashville in 63, and I mean in 67, pardon me.
Yeah.
And I'd already been married. I was married and had a kid then. But it was not, you know, Nashville is one of the most competitive towns musically in the world. And I was just going to, you know, be another one of the guys. And it was, you know, it had its own particular set of struggles. And it was just another stop along the way. It's something you got to go after. You know, I wanted to live in Nashville. I had always wanted to live in Nashville. And so when I got a chance to do it, I mean, I was determined I was going to stay there, whatever it took. And I literally, where I lived at the time, there was a hill above my house, and I literally used to go up on top of that hill and shake my fist at the city and say, you will not beat me. And, you know, I wanted it that bad. And I just stuck with it. And praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Pretty well.
That is incredible. I would shake my fist at the city. That's a picture. That's a picture. I wish there was a movie, because that's that is a picture of somebody who they have an idea and a will. It's just an amazing thing. At what point did you feel like you were succeeding?
Well, I first started. I went to Nashville actually to be a behind the scenes guy. I was going to be a record producer, songwriter, that sort of thing, studio musician. I had produced a guy for Capitol Records, and I was in Los Angeles playing some of the cuts that we had done for the record executives, and his manager said, there was a guitar in the room, said, Charlie, he had heard some of my songs, said, won't you take that guitar and play some of your songs for these people? And I did, and I got Capitol Records signed me on the spot. I walked in a record producer and walked out a recording artist. So I had a decision to make. Do I want to pursue my love of being on stage in front of people completely and totally, or do I want to just kind of keep producing records and, you know, and just do both? And I thought, no, I know where my heart is. So I went, put a band together, went back and made some records and, you know, started touring again. That was in the first record that came out was in 1971, I think it was. And I've been at it ever since, you know.
Well,
I was determined I wasn't going to make any more changes. I was going to do what I wanted to do.
At one point, did you play with the Beatles, or with the former Beatles, I should say?
I played Ringo Starr's Buku of Blues album, and I played. I spent the most fascinating day. I just happened to be in New York, and Bob Johnston called me at my hotel. He said, "Do you want to come down and play with George Harrison and Bob Dylan and a West Coast drummer named Russ Kunkel?" And I did, and we just spent the day jamming. They could not release anything because George didn't have working paper, so nothing could be released. It was just like a big jam session. And we spent the whole day just jamming, and it was just an incredible day. It was like, you could call out to Bob, one of his old songs, Bob Dylan, say, "How about playing a little bit of Gates of Eden?" And he'd go into it. Just whatever you wanted to hear, you know. It was just a fun day, but it was it's a day, of course, I'll never forget, obviously, but just a day jamming with George Harrison and Bob Dylan and Russ Kunkel. It was great.
Well, it's kind of funny when somebody asks you a question like that. It's the dumbest question. How would you like to come down and jam with Bob Dylan and George Harrison? Well, let me think about it. I'll get back to you. I gotta think. You met all these folks over the years. It sounds like you met just about everybody. You got to play with these people. Did you stay in touch with any of these folks? I mean, Bob Dylan is such a character. I can't imagine anybody knowing him very well. He's such an enigma.
I saw Bob. I went to Bob a concert in Nashville, gosh, probably a year or so ago now, and went backstage and said hello to him. But there's another whole side to Bob Dylan that you don't see. Very warm person.
When we come back, I will ask you about that. Folks, I am talking right now to Charlie Daniels, the Charlie Daniels. We'll be right back. This is the Eric Metaxas Show, and I'm talking to Charlie Daniels, the man behind this music and other music. Charlie, again, welcome to the program. You were just saying that you saw Bob Dylan about a year ago. He did a concert, and you said there's a side to him that most people don't know.
Well, I have always found Bob Dylan to be a warm person, sense of humor, talkative, conversational. It's just the environment. Maybe it's the environment I've been around him in, but there's that side to him. It, to me, is the genuine side of Bob Dylan. You know, people sometimes I can see him getting frustrated because people sometimes ask him some pretty stupid questions. People look at him like he's some kind of a, I don't know. He was hailed as the genius and the poet laureate of a generation.
Right.
And all that stuff.
Right.
That's a pretty heavy load to carry.
Right.
You know, he wrote one time, he said, you know, people used to literally come and climb up on top of his house in Woodstock. And, I mean, so you can imagine some, he'd be frustrated where he'd give some pretty off-the-wall answers to press people and all. But I found him to be, you know, he's always been that way with me. He's always been talkative and just fun. We had more fun doing Nashville Skyline. I mean, it was just a fun album. It just happened. It just, everybody was so into his music, and it was I just see him differently than a lot of the stuff I read. I just see him as being just a really nice guy.
What year did Nashville Skyline come out, roughly?
I think it was 1969.
Yeah,
right around in there. I think that's when we recorded. I'm not sure it was released that year. Probably was.
Yeah,
it was 69.
Well, no, he just reached such a level, when the Beatles are fawning over you, obviously, it's a little ridiculous. So it's crazy. And then, you know, he had this very dramatic public expression of Christian faith, which I think blew people's minds. That was in the early 80s. And I've never been clear on what happened. Many people have told me, you know, he still believes, but he just doesn't talk about it.
I personally believe he does still believe. I got that impression. We didn't have very long when I saw him the last time I saw him. It was just like there's a bunch of people trying to get to him backstage and all. I went back and said hello and split. But I got that. I think the last thing I said to him was, God bless you. And he said, God bless you. And I just think, I just feel that he still believes. I can't swear to that.
Right. I know some people who have known him, and they say that is a fact. But I think that what happened when he first came to faith, it was such a circus that I think he just backed off. He decided he didn't want the controversy or something like that. Well, the only good thing about ending an hour on the radio with Charlie Daniels is that I know I get to start a second hour with Charlie Daniels. So, Charlie, if you will hang on, we're gonna end this show. And we'll start another show. I'm just so grateful for your time and so grateful for the book. Folks, the book is called Never Look at the Empty Seats, a memoir by Charlie Daniels. Thanks for listening.
Hey, folks, you've been listening to my conversation with the great Charlie Daniels, just passed away. If you want to hear the rest of the conversation, because there's plenty more, go to our YouTube channel, The Eric Metaxas Show, and you can listen to it there. Thank you.
I ain't nothing but a simple man. They call me a redneck, a reckon that I am, but this thing's going on, make me mad down to the core. I have to work like a dog to make ends meet. There's crooked politicians and